Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net, and hopefully we didn't violate any fair usage laws there.
No one's listening to it anyway. But Hannah, is this the Nina episode? Is it the balloon episode? What's going on?
All of the above. Yes, we are going to explain the tie-in for Nina and Debond as we move forward with our episode. But yeah, it's kind of fun to have a little musical tie-in that maybe is a little bit of a tease for what's coming down the pike.
Yeah, it's a little fast song. Got a little pep to it. Now I'm ready. I brought a beer. Brought a beer today.
What's
see
beer?
If you can identify what we are drinking.
It is called Right Proper Brewing Company. And it tastes like, is it a lager, perhaps?
I believe it's a dry hopped pale ale.
Oh, it's a pale ale. And yes, I would say that if it's called Right Proper, it probably has something to do with our first movie review, which is the Jane Austen film Emma.
Emma is right proper because she's written by Jane Austen. Right Proper Brewing Company, by the way, local, Washington, D.C., has two brewery pubs you can go to in either Shaw or Brookland.
Ah, so we actually have a beer tie-in and a balloon tie-in
We're
today.
Killing it. We're killing it. They remade Emma, and you know how much I love remakes, and you drug me claws scratching
kicking
into that
and
movie
screaming
theater.
Screaming into the movie.
And truth be told, I've only seen parts of the 1996 version with Gwyneth Paltrow. I haven't seen the full thing all the way through, even though my mother played it for over and over and over again. I just never sat down and watched it. But I have seen this one, and I can declare it's pretty good.
I know. I was sitting there going, oh my gosh, you're not hating this. You're not hating this. And so I don't think I ever saw the Gwyneth Paltrow version all the way through either. I'm not a period drama person. I haven't really read Jane Austen. But I remember, and this is how long we've been doing the Cinema Clash, is we actually reviewed Love and Friendship, which was a film, yeah,
so.
Somewhere around there, based on another Jane Austen novella, and this was this looked like it was sort of cut from a similar cloth, and so I think we both went into it with a little bit of trepidation, but I think we both came out of it really feeling like, hey, that actually was rather entertaining.
It's because it's funny. It's not laugh out loud guffaw funny. It's wry. It's sneaky. It's quirky. And a lot of times it looks like a Wes Anderson film. Director Autumn de Wilde, she came up in the music video land. She did a lot of Beck videos, Rilo Kiley, The Raconteurs. And she's also a professional photographer. And the color palette she's using a lot of times looks like I'm looking at a still photo when people stop moving and just stare at the camera. It's a gorgeous looking film.
Yeah, for her feature film debut, it's quite impressive. And so, yeah, good for her. And I did. I just think it has that British sense and sensibility kind of humor that works certainly for the Downton Abbey crowd. And it's like a little bit of Little Women and Downton Abbey, and even a smidge of Parasite, all kind of put together.
Let's talk about Emma Woodhouse, the character played by Anya Taylor-Joy. We know her from The Witch, and she was in Split.
And Glass.
And Glass, mm-hmm. Very little bit in The Glass, but she did come back for that one. Do you like Emma Woodhouse as a character? She can be downright snooty.
Yeah, I don't particularly like her early on, but I do appreciate this. I do think you're seeing a character arc, a development that makes her more likable by the end. And so I don't think she's a character that you're all too happy with early on. But you kind of, you know where this one's going, ultimately. And so you're sort of going along for the ride and you're watching her. And so she's kind of snarky, but in a way that you just sort of learn to embrace as it's going along, with the hope that you'll see that character turn that is that's all important to a happy ending.
Her character turn is spurred by a man. A man changes Emma. Mr. Knightley, Mr. George Knightley, played by Johnny Flynn. I didn't know I knew who he was, but I did. I have seen him in something before. I mean, other than his bit part in Clouds of Sils Maria. He was young Albert Einstein in the Genius series at National Geographic puts on. They did like Picasso season, and he was young Einstein. I couldn't believe that's the same guy. Johnny Flynn. Sandy, our friend Sandy, mm-hmm. She says she knows him from Netflix. He was in a series called Lovesick. I've never seen Lovesick. And he gives as good as he takes. And he takes a lot of guff, but he gives it right back. Mia Goth is poor, poor Harriet Smith, who just gets used and abused. And Bill Nye, he's the comic relief as Emma's father. So a very strong, and there's more, plenty of strong supporting characters. In fact, the supporting characters are all quite a little bit one-dimensional, actually, but they're very enjoyable.
Yeah, and they each get their moment. So that's what I really also appreciated about this film is that, you know, every character, even if they were a fairly small role, got to just shine for a moment against Emma. I mean, there's still, it's all in support of Emma's story ultimately, but they were all doing a great job. And Bill Nye is just, he's just brilliant. It's because he doesn't say much in this movie, and yet his glances and his reactions, his expressions are just priceless.
Innocence. He's very funny. The script is punchy. It's very, there's no really dry moments, even though things do slow down occasionally. It moves with a particular wit. I will admit, I enjoyed this film. I didn't love this film because I wouldn't like her in real life. Like, we wouldn't hang out. She would be judging me by my bank account. But all in all, well done, Autumn de Wilde.
Yeah. Great first effort out there. And it's PG, so it's a very chaste drama.
Very surprised at
it. The only thing was that when it first opened, I was like, okay, there is a flash of a guy's butt. And then at the very end, you've got a couple of kisses. But there's nothing between there, between those two things.
What is it, the early 1800s?
It's 1800s England. And yes, and Emma is sort of, she fancies herself the matchmaker for everyone, but anticipates staying single herself until she finds the right guy that would check off all the boxes for her social status and financial well-being. Jane Austen fans will definitely embrace this and will find it amusing. It's not, we've seen the story before, we know how it will end, but it's still an enjoyable ride.
And if you've been watching the series Sex Education on Netflix, as I have, I've seen both seasons so far, you will automatically zero in on two characters. Adam from the show plays Mr. Robert Martin, and Lily from the show is so recognizable as Mrs. Elton, who shows up about halfway through the film, married to Mr. Elton. She's hysterical.
Yeah, they're all, it's again, just a solid, fun flick.
All right, you've been watching more films than I have lately, but I got one on you this week. I snuck in a film called Premature, and I first heard about it when I was watching the Independent Spirit Awards. Those are the awards held on the Santa Monica Beach in a tent the day before the Oscars. And Premature was nominated for two awards, and it won the Someone to Watch Award, which is they hand this award to a director who they say, you are very promising, and you are going places, and we know you are going places. And this year, Rashad Ernesto Green won the Someone to Watch Award for his film Premature, which takes place in Harlem and is about a girl's first real-life, true experience of a romance. We're following Ayana, played by Zora Howard, who also co-wrote the script. She's just graduated high school, and she's waiting to go all the way to Bucknell, kind of a local school. It's a Pennsylvania school. In the fall, she's a poet. She's always scribbling in her notebook, and she's going to be very literary. She is calmer than the rest of her friends, even though she can act out just as much as them on the subway as well. And she meets Isaiah. He's older than her. He's easily in his mid-20s, and he's already got his own place, and he's messing around in the music world, and they have a spark. He recognizes there is depth to her soul. They go through about a 90-minute arc of meet. It's not a meet-cute. It's meet, grow deeper. Will they or won't they? What happens? Green says this felt like radical filmmaking to him. Everybody's an African American. It's filmed in Harlem. It's not about poverty. It's not about this is your one chance to get out. There is, even if she stayed in Harlem, she would be just fine. She has options and choices. He says he just wanted to make an African American romance, a love story. And he said that felt radical, and actually it looked quite radical watching it. I really enjoyed this film.
I wonder, though, how it will do in light of the recent release of The Photograph, which I think is this drama that was sort of marketed to that same audience. And was also just meant to be this African-American romance that really does not have anything to do with oppression or anything. It really was another, a very similar vein in how that relationship was being portrayed. So I miss Premature. I think it's good to always know when there's someone to watch out for down the line, but I'm just not sure there's going to be all that much room in the marketplace and in the box office. It sounds like it's definitely a heavier watch than The Photograph,
which I believe it is. Breezy. The difference, well, the main difference is budget. Premature was nominated for the John Cassavetes Award, which means best film shot for under $500,000, which is nothing.
Yeah,
it's pocket change. It's a sneeze. And The Photograph had a wide release, mm-hmm. Thousands of theaters. Premature is going city by city, one screen. I believe this weekend it's opening in Baltimore, mm-hmm. and DC gets its one screen later on. It's a lot. I didn't see The Photograph, but I guarantee you this is so much heavier, and I want to say authentic. This is real stuff.
Yeah, I mean, The Photograph felt authentic, but was definitely lightweight. And so I do think that, Premature then might be the one to watch to just put in your queue for down the line when it becomes available.
Mm, very much. Okay, tell us why, when we let off the episode, why did I play Nina's 99 Luftballons?
Luftballons. Because we have two different movies that have a connection, not a loose connection, granted, to 99 Luftballons. The first one being a German thriller called Balloon, or Ballon. Ballon?
Ballon?
Ballon in the original German, but German with English subtitles. And it was released actually last year to coincide with the 30th anniversary of Germany's reunification. But it tells the story of
been 30 years?
Yeah.
My God.
Two German families in 1979 who pulled off this incredibly daring escape of flying in a hot air balloon from the east, from East Germany across the border into the West. And it made all sorts of headlines at the time. And so this is Germany's telling of this story, looking back, and just how the Stasi is hot on their trail. Essentially, one of the families, these two families, each with two kids, they have decided that they need to escape the oppression in the East and the socialism, and they want to be free. And so they hatch this incredibly daring plot to build a hot air balloon and make their escape. And it starts off with just sort of one family trying to make the escape, and then they crash land still on the east side, and an inspector, then it becomes like a CSI episode where there's the forensics and the inspectors are trying to figure out, trace back who had been in this balloon, who made it, and where these people are, and prevent them from escaping or even attempting another escape. And then you just sort of, it's a cat and mouse kind of drama. And, it's engaging. It was sort of edge of your seat. It definitely kept moving, and it was a very interesting story. So, yeah, the German film Balloon is the one we're talking about.
I was very surprised by Balloon and how much I did not like it. It is a true suspense thriller. It ratchets up the tension, and it's so artificial. It's so fake. I could see, there's no way. I know it's based on a true story. People did float over the border in a balloon, but not like this. They did not. And it's so fake. How could they try to get away with this nonsense?
But they did. That's why it's
no,
a good
but it wasn't
story.
The hair misses. The 1 second here, 1 second there.
You think there might be some dramatic license?
If there was a Hallmark channel for suspense thrillers, this is it.
Well, and that's just it, is that one thing I do, there was a real issue for me with the score. It was so over the top. Like, it was trying to be, this just epic thriller drama music. And so I was like, well, we don't really have that much thrilling stuff right now, but the music will hopefully make you believe that that's coming into play. But you mentioned the Hallmark version, and all I kept thinking is, you know, we keep talking about all these Americanized remakes that then happen when these foreign films come out. Well, I was shocked to discover that this was a Disney movie in 1982 called Night Crossing. And Disney did this. It was the American version actually came first. And it was one of those, you know, really, it was a total Disney. It's a family drama that's kind of, you know, a thriller in its own way. And so I'm kind of curious now to go back and watch that Disney movie. But now knowing that there was a 1982 version, I'm really curious to see if they do remake this, because I do think it's ripe for a remake. It can be done better because it is a great story. And you do, no matter what, you're rooting for these families. And the idea that that these two young couples with their children would sort of risk their children's lives to make that crossing. That's how dire the situation was. And we're just living in interesting times. And I like the fact that at the end, when you realize that it wasn't that long ago, and these people are all still alive, and some of them have been able to go back, you know, when you had that reunification, and one of the families did go back to their hometown in East Germany, or what was East Germany. And I just think it would almost play a little differently now, because 82, you still had the Cold War going on. It was before reunification. So the Disney version was really right on the heels of when this actually happened. And then this version is sort of with hindsight. And I think that this is one of those cases where, you know, you could have the German aeronauts and this could be that Americanized version that would float versus, you know, when we say, oh, this was such a great foreign film, don't mess it up by making an Americanized version. This is one where I actually could see where a remake could work.
Maybe it's that I don't like movies with hot air balloons, because I didn't like the Aeronauts either. I'm supposed to like this film. I appreciate German cinema. I was born in West Germany the year after these events took place. Other people appreciate this film. I've never been to it. There's a film festival called the Washington, D.C. Film Fest. It won Best Feature Film there last year. But it's the filmmaking, I just was so off-putting. It was not well done, and it leaves me cold.
I thought it was a tad contrived, but still, I love these based on true stories. I just love hearing about these stories that I might have missed somewhere along the way, especially when they are relatively recent history. And to realize that these families live to see that reunification. They live to see their country, you know, everything that they were fighting for and that they dreamed of actually happen. You see those photos at the end of the real families, and you realize that this absolutely did happen.
We do need films to continue to discuss the German Democratic Republic. It's fading in memory. It's going away, but every now and then it'll pop up, like in Bridge of Spies, The Lives of Others. Great film, by the way. Much better films about East Germany than this one.
Yeah, no, I agree. This is a decent thriller that once I got past sort of the initial half hour hump the guy who played the inspector, I think, kept it going for me. He was really good.
Thomas Kretschmann.
He was the best actor, I think, in this film, because you just got this underlying sense that here he was hoping to bust these people. He had to. That was his job. But there was like this underlying current of potential envy that I think he felt for them possibly succeeding and flying their way to freedom. And so for that alone, I just was rooting for these people, even though the movie as a whole did fall a little flat.
See, look at you. This is the movie you didn't want to watch, and I made you watch. I'm surprised you connected Nina to the next film. I don't really see the connection other than they played music.
No, the name of the album Did you not catch the name of the album?
Well, let's get there in a second. The music documentaries continue from last year. Last year, there were like 7, 8 music documentaries. And here's another one into 2020. Once Were Brothers, Robbie Robertson, and the Band. Executive produced, by the way, by Martin Scorsese, Ron Howard, and Brian Glazer. Some real heavy hitters. And Martin Scorsese produces it and is interviewed in it because he shot The Last Waltz. The Last Waltz is one of the most famous concert films ever made. It was from the Band's last performance in San Francisco. They brought all their friends on stage, and they're also, well, the ones who are still alive are all interviewed here. They weren't all there.
There's
like,
only one.
Well, Springsteen wasn't there, but Springsteen is interviewed, Clapton is interviewed, Peter Gabriel, Van Morrison. Well, I mean, your standard, woo, look at those guys. You have my attention. I knew of the Band. I knew some of their songs. They had already broken up by the time I was born. I didn't know their full story, but this is really Robbie Robertson's story. Mm-hmm. We start from the story of his birth. Who's his family? How'd he meet the Band? Why are they called the Band? What happened to the Band? It's okay. It's okay. Now, why are you connecting it to Nina?
Because when I went, I had that earworm of 99 Luftballons in my head after watching Balloon. And so I went and looked up that song and the artwork for the song. It said Nina DeBond. So it actually said the Band. It was Nina DeBond.
I thought you meant like the Band. I don't know, had an album named Nina. I was like, no, they didn't.
It was Nina DeBond on the artwork. So it was
all right,
the Band.
That's a great connection.
It was.
Bravo.
Oh, I didn't realize you had. See, I didn't realize you hadn't made the double connection.
No, I am not a smart man, and you're here to call me on that.
That's why I was like, Nina belongs somewhere between our reviews of Balloon and the documentary about the Band.
All the way around. So did you like Robbie Robertson and the Band more than I did?
I'm not sure it's more than you did. To me, it falls in that same vein as we've seen a bunch of these in recent months, you know, with the Woodstock films and the Echoes in the Canyon. And so this is still we're still back in that same era. And so the thing this one has going for it is, I think Imagine Entertainment with like Ron Howard's team is partially behind this one. So you know you're going to get good pacing. And I do feel that this was very well paced. I love that you get all these talking heads. You get the proper story. It is Robbie Robertson's narrative that is driving this thing because it is based on his memoir. And so, but that is a thread that kind of keeps this keeps it kind of tight. And so I appreciate the music. I appreciated learning about the Band because I certainly hadn't heard, you know, I knew of the Band as well, but I was not a fan of the Band in particular because they were sort of, just before my time too. But I know a lot of people who really, really love the Band. And I know I had heard Levon Helm's name before as a guitarist. And
he's a drummer.
Drummer, sorry. The other guy was the guitarist. But I just think that this movie is going to generate that same sort of backlash, though, where there was discord among the Band at the end.
Well, how about this for a backlash? Robbie, since he's the one, it's his film, and he's the one really in front of the camera telling his story. Mm-hmm. Three members of the Band are dead.
Yeah.
And the other one who's still alive, Garth, did not participate. There's lots of old video footage, old interviews, old archival stuff of the deceased members. But is Robbie coming off like the good one?
Yeah, I mean, that's where the backlash will be, is because apparently Garth was extensively interviewed, or was interviewed at least for this film, but it was left on the cutting room floor, so you don't know what that's about. I suspect that whatever he had to say just disrupted the narrative that this young director had created. And this director's only like 26 or something. He's somebody who was not around.
Daniel Rohr.
You know, he wasn't alive, you know, really during this time either. But the story resonated with him. But yeah, I felt like I was inclined to look up more information to really figure out what the disconnect was between Robertson and the guy that Levon Helms was his mentor for years. He's the one who really just got him in the business. And in the end, they had a falling out. And Helms did not participate I think it, when they were, I don't know if he was alive or not when they got inducted into the Hall of Fame. But you know, there was that really till the bitter end, they never really patched things up. You know, supposedly they make it sound like they did in the film, but I think other people might say that wasn't really the case because Levon Helms felt that Robbie Robertson sort of took the royalties and took all the credit for the songs that they did.
And he has his reasons to say.
He has his reasons, you know.
They were all on heroin. Yeah. I was the only one, like, still getting up in the morning to make music. This makes me want to go, I don't, maybe the reason I don't really connect with this documentary is I don't really listen to the countryside of rock. I don't care for Americana, rockabilly, and that's really what their songs are. I do want to go listen to the album, the Big Pink album that they made in the house in Woodstock. Mm-hmm. Anything after that, I don't really want to because it's not my kind of tunes.
Yeah, and I mean, I definitely almost want to see The Last Waltz, though, that Scorsese did, because they show a piece, you get a piece of the final concert that the band did that they did not necessarily at the time expect it to be their final performance. They really thought together, they really thought they were going to just be sort of taking a break, figuring things out, and then eventually they'd make their way back together and perform again. But so Scorsese ended up capturing this concert film with The Last Waltz, with their last performance. And that is considered, I think, a classic concert performance movie. And that's available, I think, on Amazon. So I might at some point check that one out.
I want to see the unedited version of The Last Waltz, allegedly. Because they're telling a story. There was a roadie that they interviewed about all the cocaine they were buying and doing backstage. And the unedited version, the one that was released in theaters way, you know, back in the 70s, Neil Young walks out with a thing of cocaine hanging out of his nose for the whole performance. And they have since removed it. It is now gone. So if you see a more recent cut of The Last Waltz, you're going to see normal Neil Young. I want to see cocaine nose Neil Young.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I'm sure plenty of people have seen both versions, with and without. And so it was 1994 that they were inducted in the Hall of Fame, and Levon Helm did not show up because this bad blood. And so, you know, that that definitely just makes you wonder. This is Robbie Robertson's perspective, so you have to sort of take that into account and just understand that that it is the, you know, it's you take your chances when you tell one side of a story. It gives you a more cohesive film, but you are going to subject yourself to some people saying, you know, that's kind of not really the way it all happened. And I was really disappointed to find out his Robertson's wife is featured somewhat prominently in this film. It looks like they have this great love story, but they've since divorced. I was like, oh, what a bummer.
They did not mention that in the movie, by the
No, they don't mention it at all. You assume they are still together and that they live this happily ever after.
That's pretty sketchy.
They're still friends, but yeah, she...
That's sketchy.
Yeah, so think little things like that when I go back and I try to learn more. Sometimes it's disappointing to learn more. And that was sort of the case with some of this. But again, you know, when you think about the David Crosby Remember My Name documentary and the Woodstock documentary, and this is just in that vein. And so it's more of the same, but definitely, you know, I think for music history buffs and fans of the band, it's still going to be a fun sort of waltz down memory lane.
Oh, well done. Bravo. Looking ahead to next week, it's a busy one. A lot of movies going on next week. I think we're going to split. You're going to see a bunch that I'm not going to, and I'm going to see a bunch that you're not going to.
Well, are you not seeing The Way Back with Ben Affleck?
No.
You're kidding.
Why would I do that? I'm not because in love with Ben Affleck like you are.
No, that's just supposed to be one. It's the biggest movie of the week.
No, and it's actually
Onward.
Not the biggest movie of the week.
But are you going to see Onward?
I'm going to take my kid after it opens. So, no, actually, I'm going to see four indies, if you will.
Yeah, we're definitely splitting up because I'm seeing the mainstream flicks. I've already seen Onward. And I definitely am going to see The Way Back. And I missed Burden. So that one.
Now we're going to both watch Greed, but I'm going to watch Daniel Radcliffe in Escape from Pretoria. I'm going to watch Will Forte in Extraordinary.
Oh, I will watch Extraordinary. Yeah. I did get that one. And maybe Wendy, but it's looking doubtful.
That one's looking doubtful. And there was another one. I don't remember what
it was.
It's
a little too much.
Oh,
but
Corpus Christi, nominated for an Oscar.
My
we're going to talk
yes.
about Corpus Christi.
Oh. Yeah, so there's tons. And so for next week, I guess I will have seen the the big movies that everyone out there might actually go and see, and you'll once again see those little ones that very few people in the world will
Nobody see. Listens to this podcast to find out what about Onward. They will listen to it to find out about, ooh, what's Harry Potter doing escaping from a South African prison?
I'm not sure about that. We'll have to find out.
Let us know about that.
Our legions of listeners, which reminds me, we did actually both miss The Invisible Man, which apparently, you know, is really getting some excellent reviews.
Good words.
It's getting very good reviews as this sort of psychological horror thriller with Elizabeth Moss. I had a friend who hated it because she just felt that the trailer and everything that she had seen, and even watching it, she said it was so obvious where it was going and what was going to happen. But then we've heard from a lot of other people that absolutely have loved this, some even calling it a masterpiece.
Yeah, your friend there is in the minority.
She is
92% on the tomatoes.
Yeah.
People are loving this thing.
And then there was another one called Seaberg that had your girl in it, Kristen Stewart.
And apparently it's not very good.
I guess not, because I don't think we ever even had an opportunity to see
it. I don't think they, I mean, we could have fought maybe, but no, they weren't really screening Kristen Stewart as Jean Seberg critics.
And Anthony Mackie's in that one, so it's just kind of sad to sort of suspect that that's probably not very good. And once again, as was last week, Portrait of a Lady on Fire is expanding into even more theaters this week.
Please go see that movie.
That's a good one to catch.
I keep hearing the commercials on NPR. I'm like, great, keep plugging this film. This is latching on to America.
Well, and they've been rolling it out, and so it's sort of like, okay, you still have a chance of catching up to it and finding it in your local art
house. And Emma has yet to expand. It started out last week in like 8 theaters. It's up to 97 this week. And next week is when it hits like 1,500.
Oh, okay. So you got a week. But
sorry,
yeah,
if it's not in a theater near you yet.
But that's also sad, because there's so much coming out next week that it's really, it's always sad when so many things come out one week and then there's weeks where there's very little.
It's busy.
It's busy.
Busy time. All right, well, thank you very much to listening to Nina. I mean, the Cinema Clash.
Debond.
I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com. Thank you.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl. Take care.